Welcome to a special episode of the ASC Podcast with John Gailey, a weekly podcast for anyone interested in the freestanding ambulatory surgery industry. This episode, recorded during the annual 2018 New Jersey Ambulatory Surgery Association meeting, is sponsored by the Priority One Group. Ambulatory surgery centers count on Priority One to deliver world-class IT services to assure optimum performance of their processes, improve productivity, and increase their cost savings, and to get the best return on their investment.
Welcome to a special episode of the ASC Podcast with John Gailey, recorded at the New Jersey Ambulatory Surgery Association Conference on June 13, 2018. We are recording from the conference at the Wilshire Grand Hotel in West Orange, New Jersey. This is Sue Cronkite, Senior Nurse Consultant with Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies. I am here with John Gailey, the owner of Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies and Eden Group Development, and one of the nation's leading ASC industry experts in regulatory compliance, finance, and administration. John is the author of over 10 books about the ASC industry and a frequent national speaker on all aspects of ambulatory surgery center management. So, John, it's great to be on the road again with the podcast, and what a beautiful venue this is.
It's great. We drove down yesterday. We were in New York City, able to attend the wonderful opening reception where we got to meet a lot of our listeners, got some good feedback. We always get good feedback from people when we're live, and we got to meet and greet with the New Jersey Association members. This is, I think I was here 2 years ago, alas. Hard for me to remember because I do so many state association meetings, but it's great to be here with this crowd. And so tell me what's going on here, Sue.
Well, it looks like a busy conference today with quite a wide range of speakers hitting all of the major topics in the ASC industry. There'll be talks about emergency preparedness and life safety, how to balance manufacturer's instructions with standards, materials management, crisis communications, and the opioid epidemic.
And I believe my friend Nelson Gomes will also be doing a session on cybersecurity. He's also a sponsor of this podcast today.
And John, I think you'll be closing the conference with a keynote.
That's right. I think I'll be finishing the conference this afternoon, talking about improving the bottom line strategies for financial success. So we, as part of this podcast, what we want to do is talk a little bit about the New Jersey Association, what's going on in New Jersey. It's a very active organization, a very active state. And I'm here with Jeff Shanton, who is the president of the New Jersey Association Ambulatory Surgery Centers. Welcome, Jeff.
Thank you, John. I appreciate it.
So it's great to have you here. Tell us a little bit about what's going on with the New Jersey Association.
Well, we've been around for 26 years. We're one of the longer tenured state organizations. We're also one of the larger ones in the country. And there's never a lack of anything going on here in New Jersey. That's for sure, to say the least. We seem to be the cockpit, like New Jersey was the cockpit of the rebellion in the War of Independence. Kind of like the same thing here.
Absolutely. So what activities, now this is your annual conference, do you have any other activities going on during
the year? We're, you know, unlike most state organizations who have one annual event, we're kind of blessed with geography. I mean, you can get anywhere in New Jersey within about 2 hours. So what we do is, aside from this annual event, we also have three quarterly meetings. So this organization is very active. People are together. You know, we're there three times a year plus the annual event. And we also do throughout the year, depending upon crises or anything, you know, that goes on, we do special education seminars. Like last November, we did one for emergency preparedness. We had one for one day down in the south part of Jersey, and then we had another one up in the northern part of New Jersey. So that's what we do.
That's great.
So New Jersey is not boring when it comes to regulatory issues.
No.
And we've reported a couple issues on the podcast here. So tell me, what's the most pressing concerns right now from a regulatory standpoint in the state?
Well, the big ones we'll go with, you know, probably the biggest one was the passage of the one-room licensure bill. That's been my baby for 8 years. And we finally got it signed into law on the last day of the tenure of Governor Christie. So that's very important. That's probably the seminal act of this organization in all of its history. We've been working on that, like I say, for 8 years. We had it passed only to be vetoed by Governor Christie in his first term because the Department of Health had some concerns about, you know, one of the provisions is that these one-room centers are not going to be subject to the ASC assessment like other multi-room centers are. And there was some concern that that would affect Medicaid reimbursement and federal funds, which turned out to be false. And the Department of Health actually put some roadblocks up. They said, well, how are we going to inspect, you know, all these centers? So we kept fighting and we got it passed in December and he signed it in January. So now we're full force. So all the one-room centers now have to be licensed or have their license application in by January of 2019.
Wonderful. And what does this mean, do you think, for the state with regard to the quality of care of ambulatory surgery centers?
Well, that was one of the main things that we wanted to do. You know, we did not want a dual track. We had a dual track. We call them one rooms. They should actually be correctly called registered surgical practices.
Yeah.
Back in 29, we had another law passed, what we call the Cody Law, and that was the definition of what a one-room, a doctor's extension of practice versus a multiple licensed by Department of Health surgical center was, and that's been there for a while, but it does not work because the one-rooms are under the auspices of Board of Medical Examiners. Well, they don't have the capability, you know what I mean, to do right. What needs to be done. Not casting any aspersions on them, but they do.
Right.
Department of Health is just more uniquely qualified and better qualified to do this. We wanted everybody to be the same. Now, that said, we realized that there would be some unique concerns for one rooms. So there's some carve outs that, you know, were put into the law. One of them concerns the state has what's called an ambulatory assessment that they will not be. Oh. When they get licensed, they will not have to pay that.
Okay.
Which makes them very happy. And
right.
The other one is, you know, we had to grandfather in some, I don't want to call it life safety, but, you know, like HVAC things and stuff like that, because a lot of these are small places that they just
right.
couldn't do it. So Department of Health has been very, very nice and cooperative. They realize what the issues are and everything like that. And I know there's been a bunch of them that have been inspected already, and I think it's going to go, you know, pretty smoothly.
Good. And it will standardize the type of care that's being provided.
It will standardize. Well, right. It will.
Surveying.
Yeah. So in other words, right now, registered surgical practice has to either be, you can be Medicare certified or accredited. You have to be one. Obviously, some of them are both.
Right.
So it just puts everybody on the same track. So,
right.
you know, we can't have any, I'm sure you and your listeners saw those. What do I want to say? I'll be pretty blunt because I am. The yellow journalism in the
yeah.
USA Today
yes.
papers about care, ambulatory care.
Yeah.
Well, we got a double barrel here because we have a pretty powerful paper up in North New Jersey who, you know, did one specific to us.
Yeah.
What that author did, though, was two weeks before they were going to run the article, she did come back to us and acknowledge, oh, you got the one room. You know. None of that was in the article,
right.
but, you know, that's what
I know.
That's
it's pretty
did.
Poor reporting, too. We
well,
actually had an episode
yeah,
on
I
that.
Mean, here's, yeah. you know, there's no relativity in it, you
mm-hmm.
know, about anything.
Exactly.
I mean, one of the things
yeah.
I say to everybody is there's 23 million cases performed in ASCs across the country.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they supposedly, this article went back to 2014 or whatever, about 4 years worth, okay?
Yeah.
Let's round it off to 80 million cases, 600 incidents.
Right.
I say to everybody, my math is pretty bad, but I bet on a calculator, there's a whole lot of zeros to the right of the decimal
point. That's right.
So
and obviously what's
yeah.
happening in hospitals is probably a much higher
yeah,
rate.
Yeah, I mean, you don't
yeah,
want to compare us to them, and it's not,
yeah.
you know, because any incident is regrettable, you know,
right.
but
mm-hmm.
incidents happen, you know, so
yeah.
you have to take everything in perspectives.
Right. Anything else going on in the regulatory environment in New Jersey?
Well, what we just had is our new governor, Governor Murphy, just signed what we call it, the out-of-network bill. It's got a very grandiose title. The concept has been around for probably 10 years because,
mm-hmm.
I mean, I remember we've been fighting this for that many years. Kind of with the new administration and the new leadership in the legislature, it was a fait accompli that it was going to get out. Though we were part of a coalition of about 20 other healthcare societies and organizations that were opposed to it, we actually had it locked up, but they made some changes to it that made it amenable to the hospital association. And the
yeah.
minute that happened, the hospital association pulled out, agreed to it. and that pulled all the senators or assemblymen who were on the committees that had hospitals in their community.
Yeah.
They now said, okay, now we'll vote for it. So yeah. There you are.
What does it mean
for ASCs? It's not terrible, okay? I mean, it really isn't. It was really originally, well, in the form it's in, it was the issue of that all states have surprise medical billing. That right. You go to a hospital, to an emergency room, and said hospital is in network, but yet the anesthesiologist or radiologist or whoever you get is out of network. And mm-hmm. You don't know that, and all of a sudden, surprise.
You got a big bill.
We have no problem with that, okay? If the bill would have just been about that, mm-hmm. would have been law years ago, because nobody's going to fight that.
Right.
Didn't happen. It got, as bills are wont to do, yeah. in every form, it got chock full of things, and it's pretty much an insurer-friendly bill. Let's just be nice and say it that way. You know, it makes disclosure and transparency, and there's nothing wrong with that. We go along with that. Still a little bit concerned as to how you're going to implement some of the stuff and things like that. And, you know, but let's just say we can live with it. We would have preferred there was an alternative bill mm-hmm. that passed out of committee that never saw the light of day on the floor. We would have preferred that.
Right.
But we look forward. We're going to work with the governor and the administration to make sure that it's implemented and do it that way.
And hopefully get some information out to your members on how to comply with the rules.
We actually are going to be doing that at our next session.
Wonderful.
I'm going to be moderating at 11 o'clock. And, okay. The bullet points of what you have to do are going to be on our website and everything. So we'll make sure they know.
Good. And we'll create a link on our special podcast thing for that. So
perfect.
Thank you very much, Jeff. We appreciate your coming.
I appreciate it. Thank you. And I'm looking forward to hearing you this afternoon.
I can't wait to do it.
Okay. Thank you, John.
Thanks, Jeff.
Bye-bye.
So we're here with Bonnie Lavoie, who is the chairperson of this conference. Bonnie's going to talk a little bit about the conference and what benefits there are for the membership.
Well, I've been with the executive board for NJASC as a member since, oh my gosh, maybe 9 years ago. And at that time, there was no conference. So I was the newest member of the board, and I said, well, why don't we try this? It's kind of a fundraiser type thing. And so we put it together very quickly in just an easy location, and we thought we would, you know, have a deficit, but we actually made $5,000. And out of that conference, we took all the surveys and we saw there was a great need for education and learning and networking. A lot of the things dealt with state regulations and quality and safety and those kinds of issues that we all face every day in our workplace. So we continued to have the conference, and this is our eighth year, and this is our biggest and our best year so far.
Wonderful.
We have expanded to 2 days, and the night before this is the first time we did this, but we will do it again. We did that to make it easy for our Southern sisters, our Southern ASCs to come up. We basically have more of our centers up in the north, so we tend to congregate here, but the Southern ASCs have a hard time getting here on time.
Yeah.
So we thought by having it the night before, they would be able to attend, and that has proven true.
And what Bonnie's referring to is we had a wonderful barbecue.
Yes.
Indoor barbecue. Yeah, yeah. But it was a wonderful barbecue.
Yeah, we had a barbecue, and it also gave our vendors time to come early and set up quickly, and they don't have to rush at 6 o'clock in the morning the day of the conference. So it's worked out very well for all of us, and I'm pretty sure we'll do that again. So what's interesting this year is due to the new New Jersey law for the one-room centers, we have about 23 new centers.
Oh, wow.
They're one rooms. They are babies to this. They've never been to a conference. They are clueless as to some of the regs that we're all familiar with and we've been dealing with.
Right.
And I can tell that because our next session is Ask the Experts. And in that panel, we have the Department of Health. We have the attorneys. We have a lot of learned people to answer questions. And I had asked for questions ahead of time. Some of the questions coming through are so basic to all of us.
Yeah.
And I go, this is a new center. This is a new center. Mm-hmm. So for the new centers, they will be asking very basic questions. And then we have the more complex ones for those of us who have been around a long time.
Yeah.
So I think the whole point of this is to get us all the same page for safety and quality and all those other things that we're trying to so hard to do. And the biggest piece for me is networking.
Yeah.
I mean, John, I see you at ASCA.
Yeah.
You know, you're a big draw. No, really. I mean, when they heard you were coming, they're like, oh, John's going to be there. Yes. So, yeah, you're a big draw.
Yeah,
so, yeah, I mean, the networking piece is huge here. Just trading, sitting down at a table and saying, how'd you do this? Or I just had a survey and what did they find? The other thing we did last night, we will expand on this, is we had a best practices competition, and we had asked surgery centers to send us their best practice, something to help them along, something that made their life easier, and share it. And we had two winners last night. one person who designed a malignant hypothermia process and another one who designed a communication process.
Which involved dogs.
Which involved
a dog.
A dog. Putting a rock
dog
in a patient bay or something. Yeah, it was cute though, and it was fun.
They're both great.
And they were given certificates and a $100 gift card to thank them for their ideas. So next year we will expand on that and hopefully we'll get more submissions.
Yeah, that was a great idea.
Yeah.
Those were both very interesting.
Yeah,
well, we're dog lovers, so anything involving a dog. And actually that was the whole point is to get something that's cute that can get people to forget about that interpersonal relationship issue that they always have in trying to take on cases.
Yeah.
That was very good. And we'll try to put some information out about that if we can. You took a copy of it, right, Sue?
The other one also I just liked. It was kind of color coding to help people know their roles in any type of an emergency.
Yeah, it was a really good idea.
They were great.
So I know you're running out of time.
To the expert panel. Yeah.
Can you just talk a little bit about what it's what members get as a member of the association?
Well, the benefits, obviously, you heard Jeff talk about the legislative side.
Right.
The other piece of that is on our website, we do keep current with everything from DOH. You can click on that website and see what's going on in the state, in the nation. We try to keep everyone, like I said, on the same page so that we're all doing the same thing and keeping our patients safe and doing quality projects and things like that. The other piece, which I think our members don't even know about, in New Jersey, the state regs are hard to come by.
Yeah.
You have to go to LexisNexis. We have them for our members. You can go on our website and you can view them and probably print them.
Without having to pay for membership.
So that's a nice benefit of just that website alone would save you a lot of trouble.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Thanks so much for joining us, Bonnie.
Okay, thank you for having me.
Thanks.
Bye.
We're here with Meg Stagliano, the CEO of Seashore Surgical Institute and Vice President of the New Jersey Association of Ambulatory Surgery Centers.
And of course, as we start this, they're wheeling cookies right by us, Meg.
And I'm a celiac, that doesn't help.
Well, I'll be right back.
There you go. So Meg, we've been talking with the board of New Jersey Association here about the benefits of membership and about what's going on in the state, including the changes with the single room centers. So we were just talking before we started this interview here about you've been talking to the state about the types of issues that these single room centers are faced with right now. So can you talk a little bit about that?
So when the legislation was passed for one room centers, they were grandfathered for physical plant, but not for life safety. And so a lot of questions have come up regarding what actually is considered physical plant versus life safety.
Yeah.
And so an example I will give you is I was recently at a one-room surgery center, and sterile processing takes place on a countertop outside of the operating room. It's not in a specific area, and the clean and soiled, so the instrument processing and the autoclaving is all done on the same countertop.
Yeah.
And so I had a discussion with the Department of Health saying, okay, they don't actually have a physical room anywhere. What can we do? And so we talked about actually being able to separate processes through policies, if at all possible, trying to at least separate clean and soiled by countertop, putting it on a separate space. And truly, what they said they're looking for is functional compliance.
Yeah.
Even though you may not be able to have the actual room, how can you manage the processes to protect the quality?
Mm-hmm. And of course, that's something that can happen in New Jersey. But if you're a CMS organization and in virtually every other, in any other state in the country, you're going to have separate rooms for those.
Yes,
those types
absolutely.
Of things. That's an exception here because of the one room requirement.
Yes, the one room requirement. And many of the one room centers, they don't participate with CMS, but they have been accredited in the past. Many of them have Quad A accreditation. And so the licensure process is new to them.
Right. So what other challenges are they facing, those one-room centers facing as they try to prepare for?
So in New Jersey, our Department of Health regulations actually require us to have a lot of resources for patients. And so we actually have to have a contract with a dietitian and a social worker and have those services available to your patients. In addition, on a quarterly basis, we have to have an APIC certified CIC infection control practitioner come through the center and do an inspection. Twice a year, we have to have a pharmacy consultant come through the surgery center. And so all of these people are going to be new to them. And so in addition to just having to develop policy and procedures to meet the Department of Health standards, they're now going to have all these specific consultants coming in and looking at what they're doing and making recommendations as well.
Right. So what you're talking about here, of course, are the requirements, licensure requirements for all ambulatory surgery centers in the state.
Correct.
Not just the one rooms here. So that's an important distinction compared to the CMS requirements, which, of course, do not require dietary or social work. I'm curious as to how often you actually have social work or dietary issues in an average surgery
center. Yeah, so it's probably pretty rare that we have the issues, but we are required to have that contract and have the service available. And most often, even in my own center, we recently had a patient come through that we felt needed social services, and we wound up referring them more through community resources, right, because otherwise there is an expense to either the patient or the surgery center. And, you know, a lot of times we're dealing with elderly patients or maybe somebody that's handicapped and they don't have resources. So we're really just trying to connect them with resources in the community.
Absolutely. And we've spoken actually a couple weeks ago about pharmacy and the importance of, we really recommend our listeners have a pharmacy consultant, whether it's required by law or not.
The other thing that as the Ambulatory Surgery Society for the state, we try to do is offer education to our ASCs. And so in New Jersey, one of the big focuses right now is we have a large issue going on with narcotics. And, you know, I think most of the country has some drug issues, but drug diversion in our state is really a hot topic, especially with Department of Health inspections. And so we just recently had one of our pharmacists do a presentation for at one of our quarterly meetings on how do you look for drug diversion in your surgery center? What mechanisms do you have in place to be monitoring for that? And one of the largest citations that the centers are actually receiving is in documentation of narcotics on the anesthesia record. And so putting into place a compliance audit that you're checking the anesthesia record against the dispensing record of what was actually given out to the anesthesiologist. And interestingly, the largest spot for diversion is actually at receipt of drugs. So the
when they first
come into the center. So someone, maybe a manager, orders two boxes of, you know, Versed, and on the ASC side, the delivery comes and one box is received. So it's really key to have it audited, and the person that's doing the receiving has to see the purchase order of what was ordered. That's the number one site of diversion, they're telling us.
Anything else going on in the state with regard to on the clinical side that you want to talk about?
Yeah, so New Jersey also is a leader in the country. We have a grant from the CDC for injection safety. And so the Department of the State of New Jersey Department of Health has a Safe Injection Ambassador program. And I recently became a participant in the program, and we learned about the CDC One Needle, One Campaign, One Patient, and specifically the issues related to surgery and how the sterile field is not different. So the same thing if you have a doctor doing, say they're doing podiatry surgery and they numb the foot, and 5 minutes later, you know, they need a little bit more local, you need a new needle, new syringe.
Right.
And historically, I think when the One Needle, One Syringe campaign came out, the operating room really wasn't considered part of that.
Yeah.
And so now there is a new focus on that.
And I believe you've been working with Betsy McCoy also, right?
Yes. And
she's actually going to be speaking in our, I think, two episodes from now.
Oh, okay. Yes. Dr. Laura Taylor runs the program for New Jersey. But actually, I think a couple other states are actually modeling programs against the New Jersey Safe Ambassador program.
Right.
They've had really great results with it. And the grant from the CDC has been renewed twice.
Wonderful. Wonderful.
Yeah.
So talk a little bit about the interaction. So you have three other conferences during the year other than this one. What types of things can our listeners expect to see during those conferences?
So at our quarterly meetings, we actually work hard to present topics that an ASC would need across the board. So we try to present things related to billing and coding. We also try to present things related to the business management of the center, maybe purchasing of supplies, and then also on the clinical side, clinical quality. The Department of Health typically comes and presents as needed, usually twice a year at the annual meeting, and then again at one of the other meetings. Again, our participants have the opportunity to interact with the vendors. And then I think really the most important is the networking with other centers. It's really an opportunity to say, hey, I'm struggling with this. What can I do with it? And one of the things that we're really starting to work on, we're very excited about, is doing benchmarking within the state and looking at doing quality studies as a group.
Oh, great.
That's great. Yeah. That's great. And sharing information, sharing policy, sharing forms, things like that is something that can come out of sitting down next to somebody during the conference here and just talking those things through. One-on-one benchmarking is very good also, just to compare ourselves to the best practices of other organizations.
Yeah, and you've brought that up before, that this industry is so good at that, you know, sharing things with other people, sharing the knowledge that you have.
We're not going to call it stealing, but it is.
They borrow stealing.
And I think sharing.
It will be especially important for those one-room centers because this is all going to be new for them. Mm-hmm. So being able to bounce ideas off each other, how are you meeting the standards? What are you doing creatively? How has it impacted your business? You know, there is a large expense to meeting all of these standards. You know, they have to actually have a staff member at their surgery center trained in infection control. And we talked about all these consultants. And so on the business end, how is that impacting their business? Because many of these one-room centers only function one day a week.
Right.
And so they may need to look at, you know, do they need to increase their cases? And the other thing the regulation has changed is, in the past, only the owner could perform cases at the surgery center. Now that the center is licensed, they can have non-owners perform cases. Mm-hmm. And so they may consider, you know, based on the expense to become licensed, from a business perspective, do we need to start expanding our services?
Right. Meg, thank you so much for coming and joining us today. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you.
Okay, here at the New Jersey Association meeting with Andrew Weiss, who's the immediate past president of the New Jersey Association. Andrew is also a very dear friend of mine. We spent a lot of time together with the Board of Ambulatory Surgery Certification. I'm the outgoing president. Andrew, thank goodness, takes over on July 1st. I mean, I've enjoyed my time. Don't get me wrong, Andrew, but...
you got paroled.
Right. I'm going to enjoy my role as immediate past president.
It's the best role.
It is.
You can't get fired from this job. It's awesome.
So, Andrew, as we were trying to figure out what to talk about here, we are talking about a wide range of topics. Let's just talk about, you know, I mean, the role of the state associations in advocacy and the importance of people getting involved with their state associations, whether it's New Jersey, New York, or any of the other states out there.
Right. You know, and I think those that are ASCA members and are familiar with ASCA, the ASC Association, it's interesting that their take on it is that to support the state associations as much as they possibly can, they know that all politics are local, that things that happen at the state level, state government level, they're harder fires to put out from Washington. You know, they need the participation of members to, you know, find out and to monitor and to lobby and advocate at our level. And in New Jersey, we're very fortunate. We have a very active state association. I think we've been around about 26 years.
Yeah.
You know, and of course, things happen. We get a surge in membership when something bad happens. Right. But, you know, the key is to be involved before that happens and to get members committed to, you know, making legislators, making them aware about our industry, making aware about the effect we have on the economy.
Right.
We're a local business.
Right. Small business.
Small business. Absolutely. Yeah. We employ a lot of people. And our state has done economic impact studies as well to demonstrate that. And on the legislative side, also patient safety, patient satisfaction, you know, issues with payers. These are all local issues.
So you've gone through a major change. Jeffrey Shanton was talking about the one-room rule here, which has basically created a large number of new members, opportunities for new members to join your organization, and of course subjected them to regulations that they hadn't been subjected to. So I know that you now have quite a number of them here at the conference. Talk a little bit about the challenges that they're going to face and what types of resources they can draw upon, both with the state association here and nationally too.
Sure.
And what they should be focusing on right now as they move move into this new era.
Yeah. The good news is that in order to be licensed, you would need to have gone through a registration process for the past few years, which means you're either accredited or Medicare certified or both.
Right.
So compliance should not be a stranger.
Yeah.
You know, the difference is the state of New Jersey has adopted the FGI guidelines for construction.
For 2014.
Right.
Right. Yeah.
Which Medicare or the accreditation bodies don't adopt. So you're going to go through a more stringent physical plant life safety requirement. So I think life safety code issues are going to probably be, you know, the number one hurdle.
Right.
Now, there are some latitude that the bill has allowed the department to take to grant waivers to grandfather centers that, you know, have some issues, but I don't believe we're there yet with knowing exactly, you know, what will be waived and what will be considered.
So the challenges for those centers as they start to, especially those that go for Medicare certification, but even even accreditation, as we know, sets a bar that's almost as the same as a CMS and sometimes higher.
Sure.
What types of resources can they find themselves if they're listening to this podcast? Hopefully they're listening to this podcast. Can they draw upon from the state association?
Sure. Yeah. Well, if you're not listening, turn it on. So call your friends. Yeah. So the fact our association has been around, you know, a long time, we have a terrific community within the state. In fact, you know, just the industry in general is a great industry because of the people involved.
Right.
You know, our website, our message board, our conferences, we have quarterly conferences. We have speakers like as we do today to address these issues. So access, I think, is key, you know, as a member, you know, whether it be our vendors, which, you know, offer consultation services in areas for development, you know, for everything. We had a great speaker today, you know, for instance, on emergency preparedness.
Right. I actually caught quite a bit of that. It was very good. I even learned stuff from that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think I've listened to every conference about it.
Well, it seems to change, you know.
It does.
quite frequently. Well, you know, and that's, you know, I think part of it. I think we have a very active Department of Health in New Jersey, and I don't mean that in a negative way, you know, but they're swamped, and they're going to be even more swamped.
With the new one bill.
Yeah. I mean, look at it this way. About 360 surgery centers in New Jersey, of which 200 now have to get licensed.
Yeah.
So that's going to, you know, and I don't know where they are on staffing. I'm sure they didn't double their staffing to handle.
Yeah.
So definitely go into the website, you know, availing yourself of that. One of the things we always say, these conferences, 50% of it is the content, 50% of it is meeting other people that
Absolutely.
Can help you out. And also calling upon, you know, talking to your state association, whether you're New Jersey or any other state, you know, calling upon the state association when you need information, often that's a good place to start. People can refer you to the right resources that are available.
Yeah, you know, because it becomes, you know, the old game, you know, whisper down the lane with rumors that, that start when something happens. You want to go to the source. You want to go to the credible source to find out, you know, what's really happening. We have folks that will promote, I'm not going to name names, but consultants, law firms, you know, that will, you know, they'll work on the fear tactic, you know, and what are the, we have the out-of-network issue or whatever. We can guide you through this. We can help you. They may or may not have the experience, you know, to guide you through. But, you know, I think it's, as you say, John, coming here, networking, finding information, if you will, from a primary source is extremely valuable.
So let's talk nationally right now. We'll talk about my favorite topic, your favorite topic, which is the CAST certification. Of course, the CAPE certification, the Certified Ambulatory Infection Preventionist Program, and the CASC, which is the Certified Ambulatory Surgery Center Administrator. Both of us are on the board of the Board of Ambulatory Surgery Certification, which is the body that oversees those two credentials. So how important do you think this credential is? You and I are both CAST, so I mean, I guess we know what our answer is going to be, but what are the benefits for people to go through that process?
Yeah, I never asked you, you know, why did you become CASC certified? But I'll tell you, for me, I first year I came into the surgery center business was the first year, our industry was the first year that the CASC was offered as 2001. Yeah. And I thought, okay, this looks like the type of validation that would, number one, help me grow personally, and also just to demonstrate and give the acknowledgement that I have all aspects of this job covered.
Right.
And again, keeping it current through the education process to keep that credential, it's meaningful.
Right. So, and it forces us to keep up to date.
Absolutely.
And never fall behind even for a short period of time.
Absolutely. There's about a little over 600, I think, CASC administrators, certified administrators in the country. We do have at ASCA, we've started having a gathering with them. And I'll tell you, they tend to be the higher level people.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
You know, the question is always asked, you know, how do I prepare? How do I, you know, how do I study? You know, you're doing your job, and we give a pretty good guide of the areas of competency that you're looking for. And then I kind of break it down to looking at it that way. When you have a staff member, you go through a competency with them, and that's how you know they're qualified to do the job. And that's pretty much, I think, the way the CASC examination works. It's not teaching you how to be an administrator. It's giving, you know, the validation that you're competent and current, you know, with it. The CAPE credential, you know, we've been getting an overwhelming response, as you know.
It's incredible. I can't wait to see what our first first test class will be, which we'll know in a couple months here.
Well, I mean, it's arguably the probably the biggest hot button for surveys right now, or any infection control issue. And as you know, the Medicare regs, you know, state that you need to have a person that's designated to be in charge of the program. I know ASCA is working to have the exam included with the next go around for interpretive guidelines to include CAPE along with the CIC recommendation. And here in New Jersey, the same, you need to have an infection control consultant. But whether you have a consultant and your state requires a consultant or not, you have to demonstrate training and education, and you have to demonstrate this person didn't just send a check in that APIC.
Right.
You know, they have to, again, it comes down to competencies. And I think our clinical folks, I'm the administrator, by the way, instead of all the other things John had.
That's right.
Good forgot point. About the day job. Yeah. So, and my background is business as well. But, you know, the clinical folks have been looking for something specific. And again, the broad range topics of infection control are certainly step one. But then when you want to bring it down to, you know, what's applicable in the ASC environment, that presents a view on things that I think, you know, that we're, you know, focused on. And I think that's why I think we've had the tremendous response.
Well, and you and I just received an email from the executive director of BASS this week that indicated that it's already starting. Like New York State, I believe, has just introduced some legislation sponsored by, I believe it was APIC, to try to require certification, which is not the case right now. In order to be an infection preventionist in an ASC, you have to have education in it, but it doesn't specify specifically what type of education or level of education, nor does it require certification. And now we're starting to see some legislation coming through on the state level, as we talk about everything is local, to start requiring that. So if that were to pass, that would kind of force people to start looking into designations such as CIC or the CAPE credential. So it's a very timely thing that we're doing right now with the association.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, taking it down to the ASC level, in the healthcare systems, I believe a lot of the infection preventionists are epidemiologists.
Right.
You know, they're not practicing clinicians. Yeah, again, that's great if you're managing.
And they're not even aware of that, the outpatient field at all, or surgery for that matter.
Correct. Yeah. So there's things that just are not applicable to what we do, you know, on, you know, either it's too stringent or not addressing. And this, you know, totally puts it into our ballpark.
So here's my question for you. As the incoming president, what's your goal for the next year?
To become the immediate past president as soon as possible. It seems to be a good job.
Fair enough.
we have, you know, certainly to increase the number of certificates in both BASC and CAPE. They are totally different exams, going after two different, not that you can't carry both, but one is very specifically geared towards infection prevention, not ignoring our CAS credential. And I think more and more we're seeing, as management companies are certainly more of a presence in the industry, they're wanting to also have that certification, both certifications. So, you know, helping to bring them into the fold, if you will, as well as to increase our faculty by increasing the number of providers.
So, and one thing that we're doing with the podcast, by the way, we just started last week offering, or 2 weeks ago, offering a credit for those sessions of ours that go over an hour. So we are an approved AU provider for BASC, and we'll be doing that for the CAS credential. And then when CAPE comes on board, we'll start doing that for CAPE, if people can put up with an hour of us talking about infection prevention. But
big topic.
Andrew, it was great talking to you, as it always is.
Always.
Thanks for joining us
My
here.
Pleasure. Thank
Thanks.
You.
So, Nelson, you own a company that works specifically in the IT area, and you have a lot of services that you can offer for our ambulatory surgery center.
Yeah.
Listeners, can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so Priority One Group, located in Rutherford, New Jersey. We've been in business since 1997, so we just celebrated our 20 years last year. We have a focus in healthcare, and within healthcare, ambulatory surgery centers is a big portion of that pie. So a lot of the services that we perform regarding IT for the ASC space in particular is we do a lot of de novos. So we do soup to nuts, from doing the clinical workflow and taking that clinical workflow and applying technology to it. So whether it's the cabling, access control, video surveillance, alarm systems, phone systems. So we do the full gamut, implement the build, And then ultimately we do the manage IT. So we manage the entire system, soup to nuts. We have our own NOC system, our NOC team that's looking at day-to-day tickets that are coming in. We've adjusted our hours because of the ASC market where, you know, at 6 o'clock, we have already staff in there. So
I was joking the other day because I got the warning of the storm in New York City from you before I got it from the weather service.
Yeah. So one of the things is, you know, we try to be as proactive as we can. So a lot of things that we do is for the ASC market and for all our clients, 7 o'clock in the morning, we have somebody at our help desk, actually several people that are already taking calls till 6 in the afternoon. So we understand the marketplace that we have to be there. So we're doing a lot of the proactive in the background where we're doing maintaining our systems on a regular basis. And at the same time, we're doing a lot of upgrades that is part of our what we do. At the same time, we do what our VCIO services where we meet with the leaders and with our clients and say, hey, these are some of the things that are coming in the next 4 quarters. Let's work with you on putting a budget together. How can we help you help your business? So we take some focus on that. We do provide a lot of the cloud services as well, and security being a big piece of what we do as well. So security is going to be something that we're going to continue with on a high level to ensure that our clients are secure and provide those services that we can make sure that they're looking at that. And at the same time, know that we are there to provide them with any support and maintenance that we need to do.
So how do they get in touch with you?
So they can call us at 201-505-1800, or you can also send me an email at ngomes, it's spelled G-O-M-E-S, at p1cgroup.com. I encourage you to follow us on Twitter. If you follow P1C Group is our Twitter handle. And on social media, we're always doing a lot of great stuff. We're putting a lot of good information out there. Like you talk about the severe weather, we always, you know, stand on top of those things so that, you know, we're preparing our clients for possible issues that can happen. So we want to be proactive about that. So that's the best way to kind of get a hold of us and keep in touch with us and kind of follow us on social media.
Great. Thanks so much, Nelson.
Thanks, John.
We are here with Nina Dietrich, principal of Nina Dietrich PR and Marketing Communications.
How you doing, Nina?
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you here. So you work with the New Jersey Association on Public Relations and Marketing and very much involved in the recent news coverage.
State of Press, yes. Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about that event and how you responded and how the State Association responded to that?
Sure. The New Jersey Association moved into action because it was prompted by an inquiry by a reporter from a local daily newspaper. The series emanated really at the national level by Gannett in cooperation with an Indy Star reporter and a reporter from Kaiser Health News that were putting together an investigative series. But a healthcare reporter from a local daily in New Jersey who knows the industry and has reported on the industry quite a bit sent an email sometime in the fall saying, hey, you know, we're doing this story and we'd like some information. And so we sort of mobilized at that point. Mm-hmm. The story was put on hold after she did an interview with our past president, Andrew Weiss, and it didn't pick up again until was Friday the 13th. I think it was February, right?
Yeah, it was. Yeah.
So it was a long time, and the reporting that she had done needed to sort of redo it. And so we had another sort of heads up that this was finally going to come out, and her story came out a week later. The association did provide an interview. Her story ran. It was pretty much what we expected. It was a tough story on the industry. It wasn't balanced, opinion. And then we needed to figure out a response. You know, we had done everything we could, I think, leading up to. We provided data. We did respond to the media inquiry because I don't think not responding is a good opportunity because you're not giving yourself any chance to address misinformation or tough questions. You want to take every opportunity. But after her story appeared, we were fully prepared to respond, and we were in crisis mode.
Yeah. So one of the now we did a podcast shortly after the event talking about, you know, how to respond to it. It was actually episode 10 for any of our listeners. It was dated March 5th. So we talked about how to respond to negative press coverage. We also actually did a skit to demonstrate how to do that. So I encourage our listeners to, you know, look at that, to be always prepared for that. But how would you recommend, because sometimes these reporters do call the centers themselves. Right. How would you recommend that they respond to that type of an inquiry?
Well, if you get an inquiry before the story runs, you need to, you know, do some research about what the reporter's coverage is like, what their media outlet that they're writing about, are they investigative in nature? Very often it will be in these kinds of situations. And just gather your facts.
Never respond right away. I mean, I always call them back and talk to them later.
Absolutely. Right. You know, no response is not a response.
Right.
You can't take issue with how the story comes out if you don't respond. And no comment just looks awful. There was a study done a little while ago, and I use this statistic all the time. 65% of people that see a no comment answer think that the company is guilty or hiding something. You know, that's just a no-win situation.
Right.
And if you don't tell your story, somebody else is going to. So,
right.
You know, my recommendation is tell your story. Tell it first. Tell it honestly.
Yeah.
And tell it often.
Right. And we've got good news. I mean, we're an incredible industry that has good outcomes. And this type of news coverage, unfortunately, masks it because a lot of the statistics that they are presenting are misleading.
Every media opportunity is an opportunity to get a good message out about our commitment to safety and quality, for example. And our role in the, you know, healthcare delivery system here in New Jersey, every opportunity. So it's a missed opportunity if you choose not to talk.
Absolutely. So one of the other concerns that we have when these articles come out is what do we do with the patients who come to our door, who are, many of them are elderly. You know, a lot of our patients are eye patients or GI patients that are coming in and they read these newspaper articles and they think, oh my goodness, I didn't expect to have some type of a negative outcome here. And hopefully they don't just immediately
cancel. Right.
You know, hopefully they come in and ask us the question. So as I said, we did a podcast where we did a role play of it. What would be your recommendation to that? And by the way, it's the receptionist often
Absolutely.
That gets that first contact.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So, you know, the first thing, let me back up a little bit. When a story comes out, your center should know who's your spokesperson.
Yeah.
And that spokesperson should be the same person that speaks to the patient, that speaks to a reporter, that speaks to referring physicians. It should be that same voice. You have to instruct your staff as the practice administrator that nobody's allowed to speak to the press or answer patient questions. You can provide a script, perhaps,
right.
but that messaging should be consistent, whether you're talking to a physician or a regulatory body or the press or the patient. It all has to be the same. You know, one thing that I say to clients is public is public. There's no degree of public information. So, the information that you're sharing with the patient should be the same information that you're sharing with the referring physician and with the media,
right.
because any information can be shared. I don't recommend that a receptionist take a phone call or answer those questions. I think it's, let me take down your questions. What's your availability? What's the number we can reach you back? And I'm going to have Dr. So-and-so or our practice administrator call you back between this time and this time.
That's very good. Very good. And if they're showing up on the day of surgery and are concerned about what's happening, take them aside.
Absolutely. And the same physician should make themselves available, talk in a room outside of the waiting room, eyeball to eyeball, and allay their concerns. And again, share the same message.
Right. And one thing that we did talk about, too, in episode 10 was that if you cannot allay the fears, don't push it. You know, let the patient take some time to think about it and make sure you give them as much information as possible. But, you know, a patient walking in with a concern is more likely going to have a negative outcome than not.
Absolutely.
Not
give
prepared.
Them time to evaluate. And you know what? They can go off and put something on the internet, a negative tweet,
that's
just
right.
perpetuates the problem. Mm-hmm. So, your advice, I think, is really, you know, well taken.
Thank you so much for your time, Nina. It's been a pleasure.
Pleasure's been mine. Thanks.
Thank you. This podcast is an educational and operational tool and is not intended to be a comprehensive resource for all rules, regulations, and standards that an ambulatory surgery center must meet. The advice provided should not be considered as, nor does it constitute, legal advice or opinion. When reviewing specific situations involving legal and regulatory issues, attorneys and other professionals should be consulted. This has been a production of Eden Group Development. All rights are reserved. We would like to thank this week's sponsor, Priority One Group. Ambulatory surgery centers count on Priority One to deliver world-class IT services to ensure optimum performance of their processes, improve productivity, increase their cost savings, and to get the best return on their IT investment. If you're interested in advertising or sponsoring with the ASC Podcast with John Gailey, please email us at info@ascpodcast.com. We would love to hear your questions and comments. Please email us at comments@ascpodcast.com.